Milt Jackson from an album called Second Nature, The Savoy Sessions. Well, joining me in the studio now is Bob Porter, who for the past few years has been devoting most of his time to reissuing jazz recordings originally produced for the Savoy record label. Savoy was a specialty label in the 1940s and 50s. The catalog included some of the first real bop sessions on record with Charlie Parker, and it featured some of the earlier sessions, which weren't quite bop, but listening back to them now, we can hear bop about to take form. In the late 40s, Savoy began recording some of the R&B bands, people like the Ravens and Big Mabel. Like many of the specialty labels, Savoy closed, folded. The wealth of recorded material was unavailable until Arista, in 1975, bought the rights to all the material in the Savoy catalog and to the unreleased tapes. This is where my guest Bob Porter enters. It has been his responsibility as producer of the Savoy reissue series to go through all the sessions, to listen to numerous takes of the same piece, to listen to albums, listen to tapes, and to then decide what to reissue and in what format. So far, he's reissued master takes and alternate takes of Charlie Parker sessions and double albums featuring Dizzy Gillespie, Billy Eckstein, Lester Young, Charles Mingus, Cannonball Adderley, Gene Ammons, and many others. He's produced a number of anthologies, including one Roots of Rock and Roll anthology. We'll be hearing a number of selections from some of these sessions during Fresh Air today. Bob Porter, before producing the Savoy session reissues, worked in artisan repertoire at Prestige Records. He's written liner notes for many recordings and writes for jazz publications, including Radio Free Jazz, a weekly column for Cashbox, and he occasionally writes for the Journal of the International Association of Jazz Record Collectors. Bob Porter, welcome to Fresh Air. Very glad you can make it here.
Thank you, Terry. In opening, I would like to just correct one, perhaps, misapprehension on your part. Savoy Records has been an ongoing entity since 1942. The only change, which I think some of the listeners might be aware of, is the fact that after a certain point, the label concentrated on its black gospel catalog, and the thrust of new recording on Savoy for the past 15 years has been generally in that direction, and they're still very active in that field today.
Well, how did Arista get to, you know, have rights to the older catalog that included the bop and the pre-bop sessions?
Well, what happened is that the founder of Savoy, Herman Lubinsky, died in 1974. And at that time, the estate had the opportunity to either continue to run the operation with its current personnel or to sell the operation. And actually, none of Lubinsky's kin was active in the operation of the record business, so it became more natural thing for them to sell the operation. Many of the original Savoy employees are still there. Fred Mendelson, for example, who's been with the label on and off for 30 years, is still in charge of the gospel program and doing very well with it.
I've sometimes gotten the feeling that it's only recently that the music industry in general has really gotten a strong sense that they can make a certain amount of profit from taking music that had already been recorded and thereby, you know, making records available again. I've seen it both in radio and in records, that there's a certain amount of recycling of the music.
I don't know whether it's record company business sense that actually gets them involved into a reissue program as much as there is a demand, perhaps from critics, from writers, from connoisseurs of the music, that brings a certain amount of pressure to bear, saying that, look, this stuff ought to be available to people. When I worked for Prestige, I worked for a gentleman named Bob Weinstock, who has since sold that label to Fantasy. But he was of the impression that good music would stand the test of time in the sense that each new generation would, in addition to gravitating to the music of its own time, would also seek out the classics of an earlier era. And I think that idea has held up very well through the years. After all, we have people today who weren't alive when Charlie Parker was alive who are very interested in his music.
How much pressure within the recording industry needs to be exerted, do you think, to get the people who are responsible for providing funds for projects like the one you're doing now to really get moving on it?
Well, this isn't really a funded project. We're looked upon as a source of revenue for Arista Records. That is to say, the Savoy program, as soon as it develops that it ends up losing money, I'm sure they're going to cancel it immediately. Fortunately, we've been successful enough at this point to continue and go on. I mean, there has been considerable interest in the field in what we're doing at Savoy, and the sales tend to reflect this. I'm not talking about sales on the natures of a Bee Gees, for example, but we have reached a situation where some of the albums which we have reissued sold more in their reissued form than they did initially. So that's encouraging in itself.
That's really interesting to hear. That's really pleasing to hear.
Well, you know, times change, attitudes change, and it takes a very qualified, very intelligent individual to pick out the best music when it's actually happening. Hindsight is everything in jazz criticism, really. You look back for the effect that music had on players of a generation. You look back to see what Charlie Parker did that influenced the generation. You know, what did Lester Young do which influenced the generation or things like that. And it's very easy to look at this from a hindsight standpoint, but it's not as easy to figure out what was great when it was current.
The looking back now seems to be coming from two very different directions. There's people who, I think, seek out older recordings because these recordings were popular when they were young, and there's a certain nostalgia quality, a certain returning to memory and experience that hearing those records again brings. And then there's people who were, you know, jazz listeners who really want to just have an overall sense of jazz history and, you know, fill in gaps in their own listening and in their own collection.
I think that's true. I think that you tend to find a certain nostalgia interest, not only in the jazz field, but even in country music, in classics, certainly, in music, say, of stage, screen, things like that. There seems to be a lot of interest in older soundtracks, older original cast productions. I don't know whether you've seen some of the work that the Smithsonian Institute is doing these days, but
we just heard a talk by Martin Williams.
Oh, did you really? Well, one of the things that Martin is involved in, apart from his jazz ventures, is reconstructing original cast albums from recorded performances of an original show, which never appeared as such in an original cast album. I think the first original cast album as such was Oklahoma in 1943. So you have a world of musical theater, for example, which is out there to be reconstructed, if it's possible, in this manner. And they're doing a marvelous job with it.
Well, let's take a listen now to one of the sessions that you produced for reissue. This is from a double album called Lester Young, Prez, the Complete Savoy Recordings. We're going to hear a recording of Blue Lester from this album. Before we hear it, can you just say a few words about putting together the Lester Young double album, like thought about?
This was purely a labor of love from my standpoint, because of all musicians, Lester Young is my favorite. He just, I think it's because I like tenor sax more than I like any other instrument, and he happens to be my favorite tenor sax player. But what we did in this specific instance, is we went back to the original session discs. This music is all from the 1940s, from the pre-tape era. And, of course, in those days, you recorded on 16-inch acetate blanks. And much of the furor that you hear today about direct-to-disc and what a new thing it is nothing new at all about it. I mean, that's how they recorded before tape. And we went back and we actually took every piece of music that Lester played on any of these sessions and collated it for this album. So there are a number of new takes involved here which were never heard prior to this release.
The piece that we're going to hear was recorded in 1944. It features Lester Young on tenor, Count Basie at the piano, Freddie Green guitar, Rodney Richardson bass, and Shadow Wilson drums, recorded in 1944. Mm-hmm. Lester, that recording is featured on a Savoy double album called Lester Young, Prez, the Complete Savoy Recordings. My guest in the studio, Bob Porter, is the producer of that album and the producer of the Savoy reissue series. This, by the way, is Fresh Air, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Do you want to say a few words about the session, who was playing in it, and
actually,
just your feelings about that piece?
Yeah, that piece featured Lester with essentially the rhythm section of the Count Basie Orchestra, with whom he was playing at the time. This was during the war, so Rodney Richardson was in for Walter Page and Shadow was in for Joe Jones, both of whom were in the service. And within 6 months after this, Lester himself would begin his own rather disastrous Army service. But this is an example of what Lester used to say, talk about telling a story. It's very easy to improvise in the sense that you can make up ideas with or without chord changes. But Lester used to say, that's all right, can you tell me a story? And you always get the feeling, whenever listening to one of Lester Young's records, that there was a little story involved in his improvisations. And I think it's one of the things that makes him my favorite musician, anyway.
One of the things that you've done on this session is issue like three takes of the same piece on the same album. So there's three takes of Circus and Rhythm, and two takes of Indiana, two takes of Ghost of a Chance, four takes of a piece called Salute to Fats. What's your approach to deciding how many takes of something you're going to put on an album?
Well, in this instance, in the case of this album, this is everything there was. There's nothing left out here. It really depends on a lot of different things. With a Charlie Parker, with a Lester Young, alternate takes are always very instructive because you're talking about two of the great improvisers in the history of the music, and what they do from take to take and how they change or how they keep whatever they used perhaps on the first take is very instructive to anybody who's interested in jazz. I don't necessarily subscribe to the idea that alternate takes are essential for everyone. In certain albums in the series, you'll want to use an alternate take not because it necessarily shows a startlingly different approach to a tune, but simply because there's not enough material to fill up an album. And alternate takes are generally appreciated by collectors, you know, people who specialize in the artist themselves. And so I never have any compunction about including alternate takes.
I guess you have to think about the sales end of it, too, because what you're saying is true. It's of great interest to people who listen to a lot of jazz, but for someone who's browsing through a record store, they're going to see the same piece done four times. Chances are it will discourage them from spending that money when the same money could get them four different tunes.
Well, I received a certain amount of flack from a New York critic with regard to this specific album. And he said, well, there are only 15 tunes on the album. Why didn't you just take the 15 tunes and put them on one side and then put all the alternate takes on the other side? But in a sense, that doesn't really change anything. Instead of having five takes of Salute to Fats back to back, you'd have four takes of Salute to Fats back to back. I figured if there's anything a real student or a real appreciator of Lester Young would appreciate, it's the ability to hear these things consecutively so that he can hear the differences.
When you first got into this project, when Arista first bought the Savoy catalog, you must have had an innumerable number of tapes to go through. What kind of order was that in? I mean, what did you basically inherit when this project started?
What I inherited was a lot of dust, in reality. The tapes, the discs, everything involved was not well kept. You know, ideally you look at a tape vault for a record company today and you want it temperature controlled, you want it arranged in some kind of reasonable alphabetical or numerical chronology so that whoever is looking for something can find it. Alas, the Savoy vault, when I got there, was scattered all over a three-story building, which was a mess in itself. The roof leaked and the floors were sagging under the weight of many different things, and I literally had to comb the whole building to find things. I found either records or tapes or discs in every room in that building except the ladies' room, and I didn't look there.
So were they labeled? Did you have to sit down and decipher what everything was, or was there some?
Fortunately, the disks were generally kept in were in all cases kept in sleeves and identified somehow or another. Tape boxes, it's a bit more difficult because Savoy was a very frugal operation. They tended to store their tapes on hubs rather than on reels, and getting 25-year-old tape from a hub onto a reel so that you can actually play it is not the easiest thing in the world. You end up with tapes breaking left and right because the early days of tape was very brittle and it would break very easily. Original tape, I don't know that you're aware of how it was in the early 50s, but original tape would break, but it would not stretch. And of course, today's tape tends to stretch but would not break, which I think is a vast improvement over the original.
It's hard to say, because a large section of it stretches. You've got whole bars that are...
Yeah, good. either way, it can be a problem for you. But the fact is that I'm still digging through stuff. We are in somewhat smaller quarters now than the old Savoy building, although it's rather an office setup at this point. But we're planning to move to slightly larger quarters around the 1st of November.
You're working out of New Jersey now.
Yes, we're in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And one of the things that I'm trying to do prior to our next move is to transfer as much of the original acetate material to tape so that I won't have to lug around these very heavy old discs to the new place. We can simply send the discs into storage and we'll have the recorded performances on tape.
Did you decide that the best thing to do at the beginning would be to, like, map out your whole system for reissuing this stuff? Or did you, you know, do it on a batch-by-batch system? You know, because I'd really like to have a sense of how far ahead
before
reissuing the first record.
It's a good question. Of course, the most important thing was to find what you were looking for in terms of being able to reissue it the first time around. In the sense that the first release that we had, which was in the spring of 76, was 8 double albums. Since then, we have branched out into single LPs as well as double albums. And generally, the decision to make single albums or double albums is mine, and it's based purely on how compatible the material would be for one album as opposed to two. I personally have a total dislike for the idea of slapping together two albums by totally different artists and totally incompatible performances. I figure if the consumer is owed one thing by anybody who's reissuing product, it's at least to get similar music. If for whatever reason there's not enough by an individual artist, at least give him something which is compatible. So in many cases, the decision as to whether to issue a single album or double album is mine totally. We tend to use our anthologies in double albums because that gives us greater breadth, greater depth that we can get into in a situation like that. Lubinsky, who owned Savoy, was not, I don't know how to say this, but let's try and be charitable. He was not well-liked by the artists who recorded for him for a variety of reasons. And for that reason, you find many situations where artists would make one four-tune session for him, for example, and never come back. But whatever they produced within that four-tune session may be very necessary to preserve that and to make it available to the general public. So you run into situations like this time after time, and our solution has been more or less to try and anthologize in double album form around a particular theme where at least all of the music, or as much as we can, is directly related to the theme of the double album.
Have you listened to everything there yet? I mean, did you...
No. In no way. I mean, I will never be able to listen to everything there. One of the things that people forget about Savoy, I think, is the fact that Lubinsky tended to acquire other labels. He acquired National, he acquired Signal, he acquired Hi-Lo, he acquired Discovery. There are any number of different labels he acquired. I haven't even found all the material on some of these labels yet. You run into a situation, for example, where some of the material is on old 16-inch discs, as we discovered. But in other situations, you have huge reels, 16-inch reels of tape, on nothing more than a pie plate and a hub, at 30 IPS, which is twice the customary recording speed. And in a situation like that, it would take you about 4 hours to listen to one tape. So I tend to go about reissuing product by the artist who is available, or a concept, if it's an anthology that we're working on. And I try and seek out at that time whatever there is by the artist that I know about.
Okay, well, let's get to another of the double albums that has been reissued. This is an album called Billy Eckstein, Mr. B and the Band, The Savoy Sessions. And from it, in a couple of minutes, we're going to be hearing Sophisticated Lady. How did you go about putting together this Billy Eckstein double album?
Well, all the Billy Eckstein material was originally recorded for the National label. It was done between 1944 and 1947. And it's a time in Eckstein's career where he was just reaching the peak of his popularity. In terms of pure popularity, he probably reached that with his move to MGM in 1947. But there was no question but he was one of the major singers of the 1940s. But the key thing during 1945, 46, and a portion of 1947 is that he fronted his own all-star big band. And when I say all-star, I'm not kidding. You have people like Dexter Gordon and Gene Ammons and Leo Parker and Sonny Stitt and Wardell Gray and Charlie Parker, who were all a part of the Reed section at one time. And trumpet players included Fats Navarro and Kenny Durham and Tommy Turrentine and Dizzy Gillespie. I mean, there were just reams of great modern jazz men who went through that band at the time. So our intent with this double album was to focus on everything which had been issued by the band and to supplement it with Eckstein's best vocal performances. We didn't necessarily choose the vocal performances on the basis of the popularity at the time, but more or less on their artistic, you know, their ability to last artistic performances.
Lester Young, who we heard from before, you described as being just about your favorite musician. How does Billy Eckstein stand up in your set of personal tastes?
Well, he's definitely one of my favorite singers. I have enough Billy Eckstein to take me a couple of days to listen to, just for personal listening tastes. I understand when people say that they don't care for Billy Eckstein because he is a stylist. He is not as an inventive a singer as many people. He's a stylist. He has his own way of approaching a song. And if you tend to appreciate the way he approaches a song and the care that goes into that, I think you can appreciate him as an artist.
Okay, from an album produced by my guest Bob Porter, we'll hear Billy Eckstein in a 1947 recording of Sophisticated Lady.
Dancing, dining, with some man in a restaurant. Tell me, is that all you want? No. Sophisticated lady, I know you'll miss the love you lost long ago. And when nobody is nigh, you sigh your little heart out, and tears dim your eyes. You've learned that fools a long, long time will never grow wise. I know the years have changed the things you used to say and do. Sophisticated lady, here's a toast to you.
Billy Eckstein from an album Mr. B and the Band. It's a double album of sessions originally issued by Savoy Records and now reissued, produced by my guest Bob Porter, who is the producer of the Savoy reissues and works from facilities in Elizabeth, New Jersey. How is that album doing as far as sales go?
It's one of our better performers. It's been a strong one right out of the gate, and it's very satisfying to me because I remember when Clive Davis originally saw the idea that we were going to reissue a Billy Eckstein album, he sent down a note saying, "Why do you want to do this artist?" And the fact that it sold very well, I think, has vindicated that judgment.
What is his attitude towards the Savoy project? Just to clarify things, Clive Davis had been with Columbia Records in a kind of questionable scandal that isn't, as far as I know, proven in one way or another. He left Columbia, and then after taking a break from the record industry, created Arista Records, which has a number of specialties. They began by issuing some tapes that were recorded in Europe, jazz musicians, and then started recording rock and roll artists here like Patti Smith, and also have the Savoy Sessions under their own auspices, and are also recording jazz musicians in America now. So, again, his attitudes towards the Savoy project, how important do you think it is to him, and what do you think his motives were in doing it as an undertaking?
The purchase of the Savoy catalog was at the instigation of Steve Backer. Steve is the jazz consultant to Arista. He's responsible for the bulk of the signings of artists there. He's the person who closed the deal to issue the Freedom label in this country. He's the person who started the new Novus series for Arista. And I think Steve provided most of the push in order to get that deal done. And at this point, I would say, as far as Mr. Davis is concerned, he likes the prestige, he likes the acclaim that the series brings to Arista in general. And I think so long as we don't start losing our shirt, that he'll be happy to continue.
Good. Okay. We're going to turn to Charlie Parker sessions next, and there's about three albums, I guess, three or four perhaps albums that you've reissued so far of Parker's work from the Savoy catalog. And if you could talk to us about the approach that you took here. Obviously, there was a real wealth of recorded material in both master takes and alternate takes, and you had to decide how you were going to repackage that for sales in the 1970s.
Well, the question of Charlie Parker it really breaks down into two separate areas. The initial album, the first album, the Master Takes album, was done that way simply because in the entire world it had never been done that way before. The original Savoy LPs tended to scatter material left and right. There was no rhyme nor reason to it. The LPs which appeared in both England, France, and Japan of the Savoy material, licensed albums which appeared overseas, tended to lump everything together in one session, that is to say, the same way we did with Lester Young. They would take all the performances and do them consecutively. Yet there was never any consideration of the average fellow in the street who likes to hear Charlie Parker but isn't really interested in hearing five consecutive takes. So the judgment was simply to take the master take, the issued performance, originally issued performance of all 30 songs that Parker did for Savoy and include it in one double album. In terms of the time, the running time, and the number of songs, it was an ideal amount for us, and we just figured that this is something that if a person wants to have one Charlie Parker album and no other, this would obviously be the one. And in that sense, it's done very well for us. It's far and away our best seller in the series, and it's been the popular success of the series so far. Now, we issued a second collection of Parker studio recordings under the title Encores. These were once again programmed individually, that is to say, one alternate take of, I believe there were 15 or 16 titles. At the time, we thought of doing that somewhat differently, but in typical fashion, I wasn't able to locate one missing session by Parker. I since have located the thing. So we've gone to great lengths to prepare a 5-record set of all the Charlie Parker studio session recordings, and they'll be on the market about the 1st of November.
Having listened to all these different Parker takes, if you were A&Ring the session and the decision initially was yours as to what was going to become the master take, do you think you would have made the same decisions that were originally made by Savoy in deciding, you know, what to commercially release?
I think so. Generally speaking, one of the things a reissue producer has to do is he more or less has to put himself in the original producer's shoes. He has to listen to performances and say, why wasn't this used? Why did they do another? You have to really investigate things like that because apart from a quality point of view, which, of course, you're always concerned with, gives you insight into how the sessions actually occurred and what went down and what was the strong point. We have to remember in many cases, not necessarily with Parker, but with some other musicians, the key musician by 1978 standards may not have been the leader of the date. Okay, and so if you hear, for example, a marvelous Fats Navarro solo on a take which was not issued, you have to say to yourself, well, maybe it was Tad Dameron's session and maybe Tad Dameron's piano solo fell apart. So you have to try and think all these things through and get a thorough perspective on the scene before you come to any conclusions.
Is it very different, do you think, you know, not having been around for the sessions? Because you're making decisions now, reissuing just on the tapes, whereas the sessions that you A&R'd at Prestige, you were there and were able to feel, I'm sure, the chemistry that went on in the session. And I'm sure that when the chemistry is really good, that your feeling for a record is really good, even if you walked in as an unbiased listener and put the headphones on, even if then it didn't sound quite as good, if you know
well,
what I'm saying.
One of the things a record producer has to do, regardless of what era he ever worked in, is he has to be totally objective about it. If, for example, I was going to a studio tomorrow to record a band, we might complete the album tomorrow. But personally, I would not want to listen to that music that was recorded for at least 2 weeks. I would want to get the impressions of what happened in the studio out of my system, so that when I went back to mix the album or assemble it, my judgment would involve merely what was on the tape, and not what went down in the studio. I mean, you have to look at these things very coldly when you come down to editing or assembling a master tape.
Okay, well, we're going to hear two takes of Chasing the Bird now, one from the Charlie Parker Master Takes album and the second from the album Encores. Could you say a few words, or do you prefer to wait till afterwards, about the differences in your mind between both these takes?
I think that might be best for the listeners, if they listened first, and we could comment upon that at the end.
Good, okay, so here we go, two takes of Chasing the Bird. The first one is the master take.
Thank you.
two takes of a 1947 session of Chasing the Bird. We heard from Charlie Parker and Miles Davis, along with Bud Powell at the piano, Tommy Potter bass, and Max Roach drums. The first one was the master take. The second was an alternate take that's featured on a Savoy reissue called Encores. And my guest in the studio is Bob Porter, who is the producer of the Savoy reissues. Bob, what were some of the differences to your ears between the master take and the alternate take now that we've heard both sessions?
Well, as I mentioned to you, Terry, in conversation here, the important thing in many instances in terms of choosing a take to release for public consumption is how well or how well executed the introductions and the endings are on a piece, because these are the things which the public hears first. The introduction, the opening melody statement, is the first thing that a listener listens to. And if you hear, for example, as you did in this last piece, in the alternate take, a reed squeak by Bird or a clam that Miles hit early on, that tends to jar a listener who is not, you know, they're seeking the solo expertise of somebody. Obviously, the master take was more together. You didn't have the reed squeak. You didn't have Miles's clam in the first chorus. That, I think, is it's purely and simply a matter of judgment on the part of the original producer. In this case, I think he was right as rain.
Of course, mistakes are sometimes at least as interesting as perfect performances are.
Yes, that's true, but sometimes the mistakes might embarrass the musician himself, and you have to remember that the A&R man is always has to take into account two factors. He has to take in the company's wishes, but he also has to deal with the artist himself. And in many cases, you don't want to alienate or run into a problem with an artist over something which can be resolved another way.
Well, in the session that we just heard, some of the artists are living and some of them are dead. Parker is dead. Miles Davis is living. You can't consult Parker, but perhaps you have to talk to his estate. Did you have to consult
Miles Davis? Not on a situation like this. I mean, Parker's material was as a leader. There isn't anything in either of these two albums, with a couple of unusual exceptions, which had not appeared on the market before. And in the instance of Bird especially, and perhaps similar to the Lester Young thing, virtually everything the man played, whether it be just a two-note false start or a four-chorus performance, is worth hearing. I mean, there are few musicians in the history of jazz who are as inventive time after time as Charlie Parker is. In fact, I can't think of anybody offhand who matched his inventiveness take to take, the different approach that he would take from take to take. In fact, any of the listeners who are listening to the previous half hour before I came on might have heard Martin Williams using two different takes of Embraceable You by Charlie Parker to demonstrate his ability to tell two totally different stories within the period of about 5 minutes, yet it was on the same piece of thematic material.
We're going to hear next Parker again, a piece of his own called Now's the Time, and we're going to hear that back-to-back with something from the Roots of Rock and Roll anthology called The Hucklebuck, a tune that was later done by Chubby Checker, is it Chubby Checker who did it?
Well, Paul Williams had the big version of it on Savoy. It was the number one R&B record of 1949, and it was one of these records that everybody covered. I mean, Benny Goodman made a version of The Hucklebuck, and, singers did versions of The Hucklebuck. It was just an extremely popular song of its era.
Well, Savoy in the 40s was recording both bop musicians and R&B musicians, and I think that listening to these two sessions back to back can give a sense of connection between the two forms.
A good point. There is a certain amount of you have to remember that, especially in the immediate post-war period, it's one of my favorite musical periods because it was like a melting pot. I mean, you had different influences from all over coming into the music. And you can hear saxophonists playing bebop players playing R&B licks here and there, and you can have R&B groups playing bebop licks. there was just an incredible amount of cross-pollination going on at the time, and it's always been a very exciting period for my listening tastes. And I think what you'll hear, for example, is that you'll hear the main strain of the Hucklebuck duplicate the melody of Charlie Parker's Now's the Time. Now, the introduction to the Hucklebuck, it has no connection whatsoever with it. This has happened before, and I'm sure it'll continue to happen in music. People talk about Jimmy Forrest's Night Train, for example, and they compare it to the Duke Ellington song Happy-Go-Lucky Local. Or they listen to Erskine Hawkins' Tippin' In, or when they listen to Duke Ellington's Don't Get Around Much Anymore. There are many cases throughout the literature of jazz where similar things have happened. Whether it's by design or whether it's by accident is hard to say. I don't think you can make a hard and fast rule who rips off who. But the Hucklebuck, of course, is one of the most famous controversies, the Hucklebuck Now's the Time thing here.
Well, the sessions that we'll hear, the Now's the Time Parker session was recorded in 45, and the Paul Williams Hucklebuck session was recorded in 1948. We'll hear Now's the Time first.
Thank you.
We've heard two recordings. We first heard Charlie Parker's recording of Now's the Time, recorded in 1945, and then we heard the Huckleback as recorded 3 years later by an R&B group led by Paul Williams, who was featured on baritone. The first album, the first record is from the Charlie Parker Master Takes session, reissued Savoy. The second is from the Roots of Rock and Roll Savoy reissue anthology. The producer of both those records and of the whole Savoy reissue series is my guest in the studio now, Bob Porter. And Bob, as we were listening to those records, you had some really interesting comments about both the trumpet solos, the first by Miles Davis.
Well, the trumpet solo by Miles, if you notice, was very legato. And this was not the bebop style at the time. Dizzy was the pace setter, and Dizzy's style has always been multi-noted. Yet Miles playing here has a lot of held notes, a lot of very mellow, melodic type of playing. And at the time, a lot of critics jumped on Miles and they said, what is this kid doing? You know, he doesn't know what he's doing. But they failed to take into consideration that Miles was heavily indebted to Freddie Webster at the time. And Freddie was a lead player, came up with Jimmy Lunsford's band. And he had one of the prettiest tones in jazz that any trumpet player had ever had. And he specialized in this type of playing. And that's where Miles was coming from at the time. It wasn't a question of him coming out of Dizzy or trying to sound different or anything. That was simply his influence at the time. The trumpet solo on the Huckleback was by Philip Gilbo, who some listeners may remember as being a part of Ray Charles' band for many years. And the interesting thing about this is that it's a rather beboppy trumpet solo to appear in what was known as the Rhythm and Blues record at the time. And Lubinsky, who owned Savoy at the time, was so furious at this bebop trumpet solo in the middle of this R&B performance that he didn't even want to put the record out. Fortunately, cooler heads prevailed, and the Huckleback became the biggest R&B record of 1949.
I'm interested in the Roots of Rock and Roll anthology, given that, you know, your area of specialty is surely jazz. I don't know what your interest is in rock and roll. Maybe that's a good place to start.
Well, I would say, without trying to split hairs or anything, that I have a considerable personal interest in rhythm and blues. I grew up in the Boston area, and at the time, it seemed to me that radio in Boston was very white and middle of the road, and Eddie Fisher and Georgia Gibbs and all this baloney. And there was one station in town which had a show that came on about 8 o'clock in the evening. And they played an incredible mixed bag of stuff. I mean, you could hear Tiny Bradshaw and the Clovers, and then you'd hear Duke Ellington and Roy Eldridge. And I just got very caught up in the music of the time. And, of course, when you're 14, 15 years old, you're not really thinking of putting labels on anything. You're not attempting to categorize music as you might later on after you become more intellectually involved. At that point, I was merely relating to whatever was coming out of the radio. And I liked it all. And I remember when I first got into the jazz business, I tended to put down rhythm and blues or anything that was even remotely commercial. But as I got involved with some of the musicians who I was recording, this would be at Prestige, say, 10 years ago, and heard their stories and where they came from and thing, I started to go back. And in all honesty, I've become more interested in blues and R&B in the past 6 or 7 years than I ever was before. It's a fascinating field as far as I'm concerned.
How did you pull this Roots of Rock and Roll anthology together?
Well, Savoy has a wide variety of blues, R&B material, ranging everywhere from the downest home country blues to the most sophisticated, almost soul recordings in the late 50s by some people. And the whole idea was what to do with it. You know, you can look at a great body of music by people who are active 20 years ago whose artistic reputation in today's market is nil. And you say, well, how do you package this? How do you make it available so that perhaps people will come to this and say, gee, that was pretty good, you know. And it was purely and simply, in my case, was watching the original telecast of Roots when you followed Alex Haley's, very probing and interesting history of his ancestors, And I looked at today's market and I said, you know, all these, you know, in reality, think about this, all music comes from something else. I mean, there are no new notes. I mean, nobody, I mean, the G sharp has always been there, right? And there are so many artists who are very active today who have direct debts to many of the people who are in this particular anthology, even though they're either uncredited and unrecognized in themselves. And I simply put together, you know, double record package of stuff I thought would be accessible and interesting to people who might be of a similar bent, people interested in exploring the roots of contemporary black music.
Well, let's hear another recording from this Roots of Rock and Roll anthology by a group that I think will be familiar to many of the people listening, the Ravens. We're going to hear Marie, which was recorded in 1949. Now, you were talking about connections that one form of music has to what preceded it. I believe Marie was written by Irving Berlin.
It was written by Irving Berlin, and jazz fans will surely be aware of the 1937 recording by Tommy Dorsey, which featured the fantastic Bunny Berrigan solo. And another interesting hook to this particular thing is that while this particular performance by the Ravens was not of hit caliber in itself, roughly 3 years later, a group on Jubilee Records called the Four Tunes took what is essentially the same arrangement and had a nice solid hit with it.
Okay, well, let's hear the Ravens' 1949 recording of Marie.
Breaking, baby. Hey, Marie. Yeah, you're soon gonna be waking. Ha 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 ha, too fine. Your little heart is breaking. Out of here, they're gonna fall as you recall. Ha ha ha, the moon and all its splendor. Get back your kisses, honey. Yes, they're so sweet and tender. Ah, for her to you, I'll gladly surrender. Not my money, honey. Hey, Marie.
Hey, Marie.
Hey, Marie.
Hey, Marie.
All right.
Marie. Marie. Da,
da, da.
Marie,
Marie,
Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie, Marie,